So my name is Corey Fagan-Bornstein. I think I have spoken on the phone or emailed with most of you. And I'm the Program Administrative Associate at the Greenwich Village Society for Historic Preservation. It's now my pleasure to introduce Andrew Dopart. He is the Director of the Historic Preservation Program and the James Marston Fitch Associate Professor of Historic Preservation at Columbia. He is a graduate of Colgate University and Columbia's Historic Preservation Program. He has been active in historic preservation in New York City for over 30 years, both as a staff member at the Landmarks Preservation Commission, as a freelance consultant, and as a teacher. He has worked extensively with neighborhood groups on preservation efforts and has completed scores of National Register nominations, Landmark Commission designation reports, and historic resource surveys for environmental reviews. Andrew's also written extensively about his passion, the architecture and development of New York City, including the award-winning Morningside Heights, The History of Its Architecture and Development, and Biography of a Tenement House in New York City, an architectural history of 97 Orchard Street. His latest house, The Row House Reborn, Architecture and Neighborhoods in New York City from 1908 to 1929, was just published, and his talk tonight, The Real Estate of Bohemia, relates to a section of this book. So please join me in welcoming Andrew Dopart.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you all for coming. My book, The Row House Reborn, examines the changes that occurred to New York City's old-fashioned, technologically obsolete, and often deteriorated row houses in the early 20th century. I became casually interested in this issue in the 1990s. But I didn't do anything about it until one day I was leading a walking tour along East 61st Street. We were looking at how you could read social hierarchy as you walk from block to block on East 61st Street. And one of my stops was an 1871 row house that had been purchased by Titanic survivors Richard and Sally Beckwith in 1919. And they had hired the architect Josephine Wright Chapman, one of the first women architects registered in New York, to completely redesign the building. Chapman replanned, redecorated, and modernized the antiquated interior. She also altered the exterior, removing the stoop and shaving away all projecting ornament, redesigning the dark and deteriorated facade with an expanse of white stucco enlivened with multi-paned window sash and other details. This is the only known image of this house, unfortunately. To my surprise, when I arrived at the site, Chapman's design had been destroyed, and in its place was an inaccurate recreation of the 1871 facade, which you see over there that I photographed yesterday. It's the wrong color, it doesn't have the stoop, and it has a lot of other problems. This occurred despite the fact that the building is in the Treadwell Farm Historic District. Indeed, as I was to discover, the Landmarks Commission unanimously approved this so-called restoration, and preservation groups enthusiastically supported the change. No one asked if anything of historical or architectural value was being lost by destroying Chapman's alteration. The destruction of Chapman's early 20th century work inspired me to begin the project that resulted in this book, a project that could not have been completed without the assistance of a mid-career grant from the James Marston Fitch Foundation and the Kress Foundation, and with grants from Joan Davidson's Furthermore Project and a Schaff grant from Columbia University. I had come to believe that the alterations made to New York's row houses in the early decades of the 20th century were architecturally and historically significant, but no one else seemed to hold this opinion. It wasn't enough for me to just say that these alterations were significant. I had to make a case for the changes that occurred in the early 20th century. Perhaps they were not really as important as I thought. But what I discovered is that a confluence of social, economic, and design developments changed the character of residential living for upper-class and middle-class New Yorkers in the second decade of the 20th century. Homebuyers, architects, real estate developers, and apartment renters rediscovered the city's rundown row house neighborhoods and redesigned the old houses to meet the demands of modern life. The conversion of these houses frequently involved the complete redesign of the facades, often with stucco, which was a fashionable material, not a cheap substitute for stone, and you can see that on the right. Other examples of redesign built on a new interest in the preservation of the city's old so-called colonial houses, and those are the preserved brick buildings like McDougal Sullivan Gardens. And I have a whole section in the book about the creation of enclaves in Greenwich Village, including McDougal Sullivan Gardens, but I'm not going to be discussing the enclaves much tonight. In addition, the formerly utilitarian rear yards were transformed into landscape gardens filled with greenery, fountains, and sculpture, as you can see over here on the east side, and interiors were reoriented to face the landscape gardens. These changes have not generally been appreciated by our generation of New Yorkers, but they were widely chronicled at the time in local newspapers. The New York Times and the New York Tribune and the New York Sun all followed this development, in real estate and architecture journals extensively, and in popular home magazines, in House and Garden, in Good Housekeeping, in Vogue, in Vanity Fair, in society magazines like Town and Country, all followed these developments. So I want to introduce you to an important movement in New York City's residential architecture, one that changed the character of several New York neighborhoods, particularly Greenwich Village, and left us with an important architectural legacy that I believe should be respected and preserved. But first, a little background. As New York City's population increased in the 19th century, development pushed north up Manhattan Island, and thousands of single-family row houses were erected. By the early 20th century, these row houses had lost their cachet. They were technologically obsolete, they had poor plumbing, they had little or no heat, they had very poor electricity, and they had antiquated kitchens, and they were stylistically out of fashion. Many had been converted into rooming houses or tenements, and that's really obvious on the houses on the left. You can see the people hanging out in the front of the house. Brick houses were seen as old and run down and were in general disrepute, but the most problematic houses were those with brownstone fronts. This is something that, you know, we take brownstone for granted. New Yorkers call all row houses brownstone, but that was not the case in the early 20th century. Monstrosities identified with the barbaric days of the city is how the New York Tribune described brownstone houses. Other critics referred to lugubrious brownstone houses or to the terrible brownstone plague. Or rude how, years back, New York was infested with a blight known as the brownstone era. So, as the city's affluent families abandoned these old row houses, where did they move? Some moved into newly fashionable apartment houses, which you can see here, this is 998 Fifth Avenue, while others who could afford it abandoned the city altogether, moving to burgeoning suburbs like Scarsdale or Pelham Manor or Greenwich. The affluent urbanite who did not wish to give up privacy and move into an apartment and did not want to resettle in the suburbs faced a dilemma. Thus, the time was right for efforts to redesign and modernize the old row houses to meet the demands for affordable, modern housing in the city. But still, it was not clear how suitable urban housing would be created on the bleak blocks of deteriorated row houses. It was an obscure architect named Frederick Sterner who came up with a revolutionary scheme for reusing the deteriorated row houses, and he was soon recognized as, quote, the father of a new period in residential design. Sterner and the architects and developers whom he influenced not only revolutionized the design of row houses, but also recast the character of several New York neighborhoods, particularly the East Side, east of Lexington Avenue, Gramercy Park, and Greenwich Village. It's hard to pin Sterner down, and his biography remains a bit obscure. He was born in England, but his father was a German who had moved to America, had become an American citizen before moving to England, where Sterner was born. Then the family resettled in Chicago when Sterner was a teenager. It's not known if Sterner had any formal architectural training before he entered the office of a Chicago architect named Willoughby Edbrook. And Edbrook had projects in Denver, and he sent Sterner out to Denver to work on these projects. And Sterner stayed in Denver, and he developed an extremely successful independent practice there, especially among the large number of English immigrants in Denver and Colorado Springs who came to work on the at high levels in investment in railroads. And this is Glen Airy. This was for one of the English immigrant railroad magnates who wanted a sort of English country home set among the red rocks of Colorado. It's a really bizarre juxtaposition of this English Tudor house in the Colorado landscape. Sterner, for reasons that nobody knows, in 1906, Sterner gave up his practice in Denver. It was very successful. He was on the social register in Denver. He was doing very well. He gives up his practice and he moves to New York. But he didn't know anybody in New York, and there was no work forthcoming. So, like other architects trying to attract clients, he decided to design a house for himself that would also serve as an advertisement for his talents. Or rather, Stirner decided to redesign an old house on East 19th Street between 3rd Avenue and Irving Place, an 1840s brick house that had become a rooming house. The location was perfect for attracting attention and publicity. And if you look at the edges of this image, you can see the edges of old brick row houses. And this was once part of that row of brick houses from the 1840s. So what did Stirner do with the house that he purchased? First, he removed the stoop and created a new main entrance in the basement, and he also removed the old cornice. Most importantly, Stirner covered the old brick with a coating of subtly textured, unpainted stucco that's described by contemporaries as either light gray or cream in color. Although there's no time this evening to discuss stucco in detail, suffice it to say that stucco was becoming an increasingly popular material in the early 20th century, in part because it was inexpensive, easy to purchase, easy to use, and could be worked by trained craftsmen into many different textures. So you could purchase it. I liken stucco to Aunt Jemima pancake batter. You could buy a bag of stucco and just add water. And basically, you had it. And also, the big advance was you could now, in the early 20th century, you could get it in a cream color, as opposed to a kind of gray that it had previously been. The other really important thing about stucco was that it was what I call the un-brownstone. So it was bright, it was light, and it wasn't brown. It wasn't the lugubrious brownstone. The light-colored stucco used on 19th Street provided a background for a more colorful ornament. Plenty of color, explained Stirner. That's what we need in our architecture. We mustn't be afraid of color. We aren't Puritans anymore. Following this precept, Stirner capped the house with a parapet that was clad in red Spanish tile, which you can see at the top. He added multi-pane window sash and panel shutters that were painted light green, and built the entry stair and new areaway wall with dark red brick, which you can see here. Stirner's most spectacular use of color is in the entrance, which he surrounded with brightly glazed Moravian tiles. These are tiles that were made by Henry Mercer in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Stirner also incorporated tiles into the unusual molded concrete planters that he designed on the walls. You can see one on the left here. The colorful facade must have originally been a striking sight on a block of dirty, deteriorated red brick and brownstone houses. But he didn't just limit himself to changing the front facade of the building. He also changed the rear of the building. The backyard, the traditional backyard in New York, was utilitarian. It was dirt. It didn't have grass. Nobody grew tomato plants out there and put in marigolds. It was a dirt with wooden walls, and you hung your laundry out there. And Stirner completely transformed the notion of what a rear yard could be. The yards were, as one observer noted, a dreary waste from time immemorial, perpetuated to the use of clotheslines and other unpicturesque sights such as the garbage can and the ash barrel. So Stirner took down the wooden walls and he built these brick walls out of clinker bricks, that is, bricks that looked like they were centuries old, but they were brand new, actually. They were manufactured to look old. And he created an Italian garden in the back. There's a statue of Diana. There's a fountain, more of those concrete urns. If you just look up at the top right here, you can see that there's a trellis that runs over this. There was also rattan furniture back here. So he's turned the utilitarian yard into an asset to the house, into a beautiful garden. He also completely rethought the plan of the row house. Now, you know that in the typical New York row house, in the basement, the kitchen's in the back, and then it moves, and then there's a front room that could be a dining room or a billiard room or whatever you wanted to use it for. And upstairs, there's a dining room in the back and a front parlor. And then the master bedroom is in the front, overlooking the street. So what Stirner did is he turns the house around. He moves the kitchen from the back where it had been to the front. And the size of the kitchen shrinks because now you didn't need a huge kitchen anymore because the size of stoves had declined. There was all this modern technology And so the kitchen didn't need to have all that space in the back. It could move to the front. And also the yard didn't need to be utilitarian because you could now send your laundry out to automate a mechanical laundry. So you didn't have to worry about the rear yard. So everything now focuses on the garden. The dining room's moved to the back. The drawing room, the library, and his architecture studio all now look out at the back of the house towards the garden. And you can see that in this image of the dining room. Here's Diana in the garden. So the doors open right out into the garden. You can see the interior is very traditional. He was an Anglophile. It's a mix of modern imitation and antique furniture, creating a very traditional oldie English interior, probably designed by his sister Maud, who was an interior decorator whom he lived with. He was unmarried. He lived with his sister in a series of houses in the city. This was a huge success. It cost $12,000 to do all this work. It was an enormous success. It got an incredible amount of press, and it established Stirner as an architect in New York. Stirner's house had an immediate impact on his professional career, resulting in a series of commissions to redesign row houses and for other projects, primarily for a group of wealthy, socially well-connected, and artistically inclined New Yorkers, including a number of artists on 19th Street. And every house except this one here was redesigned by Stirner in the second decade of the 20th century. And here you can see some of the details of what he did. A writer for the New York Sun in 1910 reported that 19th Street has, quote, become one of the most interesting and artistic bits of real estate in New York. And then he presciently noted the promise of this type of reclamation, as he called it, to transform the whole ugly city into a livable, lovable place. While Stirner's model for reclaiming old row houses did not transform the entire city, it did have a major impact on several other old New York neighborhoods, including Greenwich Village. Stirner was not content with a single example of a revitalized block, so he looked for other deteriorated old houses that he could purchase inexpensively and redesign. Over the next few years, he redesigned several old houses for his own use on the east side. He moved to the east side, east of Lexington Avenue, and these are the two major examples. They were both for himself and his sister. This one on East 63rd Street, which survives only from there up and without the artist's studio, and Parge House on the right, one of the most extraordinary houses designed by Stirner with all its three-dimensional sculpture on it, which is on Lexington and 65th Street. These houses were extremely influential, leading to a major movement by wealthy families onto the blocks east of Lexington Avenue, a move frequently accompanied by the redesign of old row house gardens. And here you can see a couple of other houses Stirner designed on the east side on the upper left, and then three of the gardens that become characteristic of this whole movement. These are private house gardens, and this is Turtle Bay Gardens, where 22 yards were combined to create one large unified community garden. The movement to redesign old row houses was not limited to wealthy neighborhoods or to single-family houses. The success of Stirner's model also inspired real estate developers to remodel deteriorated row houses into apartments for artistically inclined New Yorkers, primarily in Greenwich Village. As most of you know, Greenwich Village developed in the first half of the 19th century with houses built to attract households with a range of incomes. The character of many sections of the village changed dramatically in the final decades of the 19th century as large numbers of immigrants settled in the village. And by the early 20th century, the South Village and almost the entire West Village were Italian. In addition to the foreign immigrants, the early 20th century village, of course, saw the influx of young, avant-garde, and often politically radical bohemian artists, writers, and musicians. As many historians have chronicled, this group was never large in number, but it had a tremendous influence on the character of Greenwich Village and indeed on the intellectual development of the United States. The transformation of the housing market in Greenwich Village in the second decade of the 20th century was initiated by real estate developer Vincent Pepe. Pepe sponsored development projects that radically altered both the appearance and use of many row houses. Although virtually unknown today, Pepe Pepe was a well-known figure in New York's early 20th century real estate circles. He was a ceaseless publicist for Greenwich Village, as well as being an extraordinary self-promoter. Although an Italian immigrant, coming to the United States as a child, the New York Times reported that he has lived in Greenwich Village so long as to be thoroughly saturated with its old-time traditions, and he outrivals many natives of the locality in his loyalty to the place. So aggressive was Pepe as a developer that one critic declared that the area was not the Republic of Greenwich Village, as the Bohemians had dubbed it, but was the Republic of Vincent Pepe. By about 1914, Pepe had become aware of the possibility of profitably capitalizing on the artistic and bohemian reputation of Greenwich Village by attracting residents who could pay higher rents than most of the bohemian artists and writers. He hoped to take advantage of the increasingly large number of single professionals, including many single women, entering the job market and looking for apartments away from their families. And Greenwich Village was very attractive to these single people. It was relatively safe, it had an artistic ambiance, and it was very well located between business in Lower Manhattan and business in the new downtown that was developing in Midtown. So the village becomes a really prime location for these young single people. Pepe's interest coincided with that of several business and neighborhood groups that sought to preserve and restore the village as a central residential area. Indeed, in 1914, Pepe wrote a promotional booklet for a local improvement organization called the People's Institute, and this was funded by the Central Mercantile Association, a business group in Greenwich Village in Chelsea. This little book is entitled, "How Would You Like to Open One of These Doors in Greenwich Village?" And this is the frontispiece, which says, "How would you like to open a door like this 10 minutes away, 10 minutes after you punch the clock?" So you know, you're working only 10 minutes away from this. And it's illustrated with an 1820s Federal-style house. In this small publication, Pepe touted the promise of Greenwich Village as a revived residential neighborhood. He noted that the village was not for those who, like row after row of unvarying apartment houses on streets as straight and stiff as a music staff, and are content to live in a flat exactly like 5,000 other flats, but for those who have eyes that are caught by quaintness and individuality, and who find romance in a cluster of small brick houses tucked away in an odd corner of the great city. Pepe soon realized that quaint houses alone would not attract affluent renters. One look he remembered in 1919 at the unimproved interiors of the houses discouraged them, no matter how keen they were about picturesque qualities of the places shown them. In other words, if you could afford it, it might look nice, but if it didn't have heat or electricity or modern plumbing, you weren't going to move in. In order to attract tenants who would pay rents that would increase the profitability of neglected houses, he would have to provide appropriate apartments with large rooms, modern amenities such as steam heat, electricity, and up-to-date plumbing. This he began to do, but the exteriors remained unimproved. Pepe acknowledged that it was a visit to Gramercy Park, where Stirner had worked, that inspired him to begin redesigning the facades of village row houses. "One day," said Pepe, "I happened to be in the Gramercy Park section, and I noticed a very attractive remodeled house. Later, I made up my mind that the Washington Square section could adapt itself to this class of improvement." The pioneering example in Greenwich Village of such a complete renovation of a row house is 124 Waverly Place, built in 1838 in the Greek Revival style, that had become a rooming house occupied by 12 people. And here you can see the before and the after. That's the design of the after. The architect for this rehabilitation was Frank Vitolo, a little-known practitioner who worked with Pepe on several village projects, installing heating, plumbing, and electrical systems, and altering the exteriors. On this house, you can see the plan was to keep the stoop, but to remove the doorway and frame it. Here, the old heavy Greek Revival doorway and framing. Strip the window lintels, remove the cornice, and alter all the windows on the right side of the building. So everything's shaved back to create a flat facade. Then it was a smooth, light-colored stucco was applied to the facade. Studio windows, artist studio windows with multi-pane casements, that is, windows that open out, were created. There are sash windows and casement windows here. The window frames were painted green to add color, and then it was embellished with artistic details, like Spanish tile on the doorway hood here and on the roof, and iron balconies here for hanging for flower boxes, so that you'd have greenery as well. Pepe and Vitolo's choice of stucco for the facade of 124 Waverly, and especially their addition of large artist studio windows, became a model for other rehabilitated row houses in Greenwich Village, whether or not the apartments were actually planned for artists. The studio windows exploited the image of Greenwich Village as a bohemian, Parisian-inspired artistic center, further enhancing the notion that Greenwich Village was, as many critics dubbed it, the Latin Quarter of America. A New York Times writer stated, "The requirements of the artists and the allied professions have been catered to on Waverly Place." This, however, was not Pepe's intent. He explained that while the alterations might meet the requirements of artists, the demand for the altered private house is not only for those interested in art, but for the general public. The attorney, the Wall Street broker, and staple businessmen are among those who prefer to reside in this locality. Undoubtedly, many of the new residents enjoyed the idea of living in apartments that resembled artist studios. So you see a modern theme here, the idea of creating an idea based on artist housing and then non-artists move in. You know, just like in the 1960s, everybody suddenly wanted to live in a loft in Soho. Or once artists discovered Williamsburg in more recent years, suddenly it was the hippest place for everybody, whether you were an artist or not, to live. And that was the idea here. So here's this real estate developer feeding on the notion of Greenwich Village as a bohemian center to attract people who could pay higher rents. That's why I call this talk the real estate of Bohemia. Vitolo's design had originally called for the removal of all of the Greek Revival features, and you can see a detail of his design for the door here, and a detail of the door as it was eventually designed. One prospective tenant complained about the imminent destruction of the original front door with its flanking pilasters and of the destruction of the iron areaway railing. According to the New York Times, he accused the owner, agent, and builder of not possessing the least artistic taste in architecture. Pepe immediately changed his plans. We realized, he admitted, that we were making a mistake, and neither the door nor the railing was changed. Pepe claimed that he even salvaged the original bronze doorknob from the garbage. The preservation of these features had the added advantage of saving Pepe $300, something I'm sure he was very happy about. This also marks the beginning of an interest in colonial architecture in Greenwich Village. And by colonial, in the early 20th century, they meant all the early brick buildings, the Federal and Greek Revival style buildings, never mind that they weren't built during the colonial period historically, but they were referred to as colonial architecture. And this would result in the preservation of many older details, even on the rehabilitated row houses. Between 1915 and 1930, some facades in the village were totally redesigned with European-inspired stucco, while others had studios added but retained their colonial features. And you can see these have stucco fronts on them on 9th Street. This is a brick house. It's been painted, but this is a brick house where studio windows were added to it. And an old veranda was also added to it. A debate ensued among village artists as to which type of design was more appropriate for the neighborhood, the stuccoed studios that took their cue from Paris or the more American brick buildings. Sculptor Edward Sanford argued that Greenwich Village should not look like Paris. He found individuality and quaintness in the spirit of old New York, concluding, "We don't need Paris here. To me, there is more charm in a colonial doorway than in a house full of stucco." In response, William Glackens, an artist who was inspired by French Impressionism, was a partisan for Parisian design. "Parisian? Fine. I hate the old colonial type of house. What we need is a little warmth, a little color to cheer up the grayness of the city." The project at 124 Waverly was extremely successful. All of the units were rented even before construction was completed, and the rent roll rose from $1,000 a year to $3,660 a year, and Pepe soon sold the building at a profit. Although not listed in any guidebooks, 124 Waverly remains one of the most architecturally and historically significant houses in Greenwich Village. And you can see it's largely intact. There have been, the Spanish tile, unfortunately, is gone. And there's been some minor changes to the windows. But otherwise, oh, and the balconies are gone, unfortunately. But otherwise, it's there and really records the beginning of this movement that was to transform the village. The success of the rehabilitation at 124 Waverly vindicated Pepe's assessment of the promise of the Washington Square area for profitable housing. 124 Waverly set the stage for houses that, according to one local critic, were reclaimed from a dilapidated brownstone or crumbling brick past to a smart and old-world picturesqueness. And you can see some other examples. This is on 8th Street, and you can see there's a whole slew of artist studio windows on the block, many of which still survive. And this is on Washington Place here, completely redesigned, although it faces south, so it doesn't have the artist studio windows on the front. The studios really become characteristic of the neighborhood, and if you walk around in the village tuning into this, you'll see artist studio windows all over on the village, especially in facades that face north. The largest rehabilitation venture was a project undertaken by Sailor Snug Harbor in 1916 that transformed a complex of deteriorated row houses and stables into an extraordinary group of arts and crafts apartment buildings and studios. Land north of Washington Square and east of Fifth Avenue had been deeded to Sailor Snug Harbor in the early 19th century and was leased on long term by the harbor, which was supported by these rents. Elegant houses were erected, but by the early 20th century, most of these had become stores and factories, and you can see here, there are a lot of furriers on this block. You can see storefronts, signage. They were quite deteriorated. In 1916, Sailor Snug Harbor, they were getting a lot of pressure from the Washington Square Association to do something about this. And in 1916, Sailor Snug Harbor hired the architect Julius Franke to salvage 9 deteriorated row houses on East 8th Street and 10 adjoining stables on Washington Mews. This project was a business proposition for Sailor Snug Harbor, which hoped to increase its income by upgrading the property. Thus, a decision was made to combine the row houses into apartment buildings with traditional apartments as well as artist studios. According to the Times, Franke turned the buildings from a dirty, dingy, uninteresting little business block backed by an unsightly row of stables into a square of artist studios, the double of which can be found only in one of the rues of the Latin Quarter of Paris. In designing the project, Franke was handicapped by the fact that he was unable to overhaul all of the buildings on 8th Street since leases for several of the row houses were still in private hands. And you can see that there's one right here that hasn't been altered, and then here and here. They couldn't get a hold of all of the houses. Thus, he designed 3 separate but related units. He adapted the idea of cladding the old facades in stucco that Stirner had introduced in Gramercy Park and Pepe had pioneered in Greenwich Village. The light-colored stucco is enlivened with one of the most extensive installations of Moravian tile in New York City, and it's filled with these colored tiles ordered from Doylestown. In fact, the order is still in the archives there. We can see everything that he ordered. On Washington Mews, Franke redesigned the 2-story structures in a unified manner, creating an enclave that resembles one of the small artist cul-de-sacs in Paris. Despite the inclusion of studio windows on 8th Street, and you can see them up here, here, and here, despite the inclusion of studio windows on 8th Street and at the rear of the Washington Mews houses, which you can see here, which overlook a common combined garden, only one of the Mews buildings was rented to an artist, and no artists are recorded on 8th Street in the 1920 census. So it was all people, again, it was writers and a lot of professionals, mostly single, who wanted to live like artists. Almost from the start of rehabilitation work in Greenwich Village, some critics had complained that its major impact was rising rents that forced real artists and writers out of the neighborhood. Criticism is evident in bohemian circles as early as 1916. When Bruno's Weekly, a local artistic magazine published by a really crazy character in the village called Guido Bruno, who was indeed a real bohemian, he was a Czech immigrant, and he advocated for the artists, but he also made his money by, as a tour guide and building up tourism, bohemian tourism in Greenwich Village. He observed in his magazine that he published, Bruno's Weekly, that Greenwich Village has become a marvelous background for the real estate shark. The sharks were men like Pepe, who are upgrading the old row houses, creating studios, and raising rents. Bruno was especially disturbed by the character of the tenants who were moving into the new apartments. They were not artists and writers, but, he said, quote, artistically inclined shirt merchants and atmosphere-crazy shoe manufacturers, as well as art enthusiasts from Peoria and East Oshkosh, who come to New York to satisfy their craving for art and atmosphere. Indeed, so many villagers hailed from the Midwest that a writer for the Ladies' Home Journal quipped that Greenwich Village is the Cobb of the Corn Belt. Indeed, almost no artists lived in Sailor Snug Harbor's buildings, and by 1920, the Washington Square area was largely unaffordable to all but the most successful artists. A writer for another of the village's many little journals wrote, "It was Vincent Pepe who conceived the bright idea of having artists colonize a slum and then gradually improve the district by crowding out the wicked, vicious, and slovenly tenants." This is exactly the story of Dumbo in more recent years. You know, owners renting inexpensively to the artists who established a new neighborhood. Perhaps it was through accident that this stunt was discovered. Perhaps Pepe found that he could not get any money out of the artists and that he might as well use them for any purpose he could. Having served Pepe's purpose, artists were now themselves being dislocated by rising rents. And this is summed up most particularly in this Tribune that was published, this cartoon that was published in the New York Tribune in 1921. This is by Albert Levering, and it shows a sharply dressed realtor, undoubtedly Pepe, standing just beyond a sign on the Washington Mews entrance here, advertising atelier for rent, but just in case you don't speak French, it translates it. Studio, atelier, studio for rent. Accompanied by two elegant swells and their chauffeur here, these potential renters sneer at an ill-kempt artist with scraggly beard and dangling cigarette who clasps palette, canvases, dripping paint box, and brushes as he sadly departs from his studio on the Mews. I think this really sums it up, what was happening. As the center of Bohemian Greenwich Village shifted west, towards and past Sheridan Square, so did the activities of Pepe and the other renovators. During the 1920s, extensive renovation work transformed the rundown blocks of the West Village. Much of the rehabilitation work capitalized on the quaint colonial character of the Federal and Greek Revival style row houses that lined many of the streets. In concert with interior alterations and modernizations, studio windows and casement sash might be added to otherwise unaltered facades, as here on 11th Street. This house once looked like this house, except for this pediment, which is not original. But you can see they've put in casement windows on this floor, an artist's studio up here, and a studio window over here. Or you could do the same thing and remove the stoop, as was done here. Three studio windows added. Original cornice is preserved, but they've taken the stoop off. Or you might add studios to the roof, as here on Greenwich Street, on Greenwich Avenue. Both of these are on Greenwich Avenue. Or you might add additional, you might remove the stoops and add additional detail to a building. This is on Charles Street. The artist studios with casements are added here. In fact, all the windows are now steel casement windows. You see steel casements all over the village. And so you should tune into that. And then they salvaged this veranda here and placed it on here. And this, sadly, this was also photographed by Berenice Abbott for Changing New York. This is not her photo, but it was photographed by her. And this survived until recently. And even though it's in the Landmark District, the owner has removed the veranda. And sad to say, the Landmarks Commission has done nothing to get this put back on the building. Really iconic because Berenice Abbott photographed it, and it's a real sad loss to the village. While many developers preferred to preserve historic features of the old houses, a series of row houses were completely redesigned during the 1920s in a manner that introduced picturesque European-inspired design to the far west village. At the same time, many developers dropped the pretense of creating homes for artists and simply upgraded their buildings and redesigned the exteriors, creating more modern and more marketable buildings. And I should note that many of these also had little small landscape gardens in the back. An example of this is 93 Perry Street, one of the finest of the European-inspired remodeling projects in the village, where no studio windows were included. An advertisement placed by the owners in 1928 compared the building to Old New Orleans and attempted to attract tenants by describing it as, quote, the quaintest bachelor apartments in the village. This building has most minute apartments in it. Here's an old view, and here it is today, largely intact. And here's the ad for the bachelor apartments and Old New Orleans here. There's actually, the reason for this arch is there's actually a rear building that you can just see peeking out over here that was also redesigned as part of this project. Indeed, many units created as part of the rehabilitation project in the village were referred to as bachelor apartments, or more officially, non-housekeeping units. This meant that the apartments did not have kitchens. Why would developers invest in upgrading the old row houses, providing modern electrical wiring, heating, and plumbing, but choose to offer apartments for rent that did not have kitchens? The proliferation of these apartments was a way for the real estate interests to get around the requirements of New York City's tenement law, which guided the design of all buildings that house three or more households, each one cooking separately. So as long as you had a maximum of two kitchens, you didn't have to follow the tenement laws. Therefore, these buildings did not have to follow the strict guidelines for fireproofing, means of egress, lot coverage, and minimum room size. In fact, these have such small rooms they probably wouldn't meet code. In order to avoid this, most rehabilitation projects with multiple apartments included no more than two units with full kitchens. The others were non-housekeeping units. Thus, the buildings were not officially tenements. The transformation of row houses into multiple dwellings with non-housekeeping units was a ruse by which property owners and real estate developers avoided the expense of meeting the tenement law's really heavy requirements. Most of the non-housekeeping units were provided with sinks and space where a tenant or a landlord could install an illegal kitchen. And so this is a good example of that. This is 39 Grove Street that was redesigned in 1920. By an architect named Robert Gottlieb. It's stucco filled with tile on it. In fact, the owner was a tile dealer. And here's a plan of it. This is the second floor plan. It's the same plan on every floor, up through the fourth floor. But on the fourth floor, on the top floor, these dressing closets here are kitchens. So what does that mean? That means that all of the utilities go right up the building. So there's plumbing, there's gas or electricity, whatever they had in the stove. It's going right up the building, so it made it incredibly easy for anyone to convert the dressing closet into a kitchen, which of course is what everybody did. And today, if you go into the building, that's where the kitchen is in these small apartments. This didn't fool anybody. The Department of Buildings knew that this was going on, and in fact, in 1929, the law was changed to help legalize buildings like this. The units in many of these rehabilitated row houses, especially those converted in the 1920s, as I mentioned, were extremely small. These tiny apartments were marketed to relatively affluent, single people attracted to the atmosphere of the village. For example, the small apartments of Twin Peaks, a project dating from 1925, planned according to the architectural record to provide housing suitable for the cultural worker. But the census doesn't show any cultural workers living in these buildings. It was young professionals living here. They were provided with atmospheric amenities such as brick fireplaces and what were called medieval peasant-type beds with storage space beneath, which you can see here. The New York Times said these resembled built-in bathtubs. Twin Peaks, of course, is one of the most unusual buildings in the village, one that would have been even more striking originally when it was painted black with orange, blue, and green trim. So it's hard to imagine, but you can actually see that in the image, that it's very dark. Here it was black, and the trim over here was orange, blue, and green. The project was the idea of owner-architect Clifford Daley, who was backed by wealthy financier and art patron Otto Kahn, who, while funding the Metropolitan Opera, also spent time in the Bohemian haunts in the village, where he met Daley. Kahn and Daley arranged a spectacular dedication ceremony for the building in 1925, film star Mabel Normand stood on one of the gables and christened the building by smashing a bottle of what was referred to as pre-Napoleon champagne, while Princess Amalie Trubetskoy, born Amalie Reeves in Richmond, Virginia, but married a Russian, burned acorns in a bronze brazier as a votive offering to Pan. The princess's pagan ritual was complemented by a sprinkling of holy water by Roman Catholic Archbishop William Henry Francis of Chicago. Finally, another participant mounted the ridgepole of one of the gables and tossed armfuls of flowers at guests in the street, including actresses Minnie Madden Fisk and Helen Hayes. The success of the conversion projects resulted in extraordinary pressure on Greenwich Village real estate. Realtors reported that there were long waiting lists for the small apartments. By the time the stock market crashed in 1929, the rehabilitation of Greenwich Village row houses had extended across the neighborhood. Over the years, many of these rehabilitated houses have been poorly treated. Some have even received permits from the Landmarks Preservation Commission to remove features such as the artist's studio windows dating from the early 20th century. My book has examined how the movement to redesign row houses in New York was a significant development in the early decades of the 20th century. The movement was widely appreciated at the time. Writers and critics understood that they were witnessing the transformation of many of the city's rundown neighborhoods and that these physical changes reflected changes in patterns of urban residential life. Thus, I argue, an appreciation of the history of these houses is essential to an understanding of the evolution of urban residential life, and the preservation of surviving examples of this movement celebrates an important, if hitherto underappreciated, development in early 20th century urban architecture, a movement that created much of the character of Greenwich Village that we cherish today. Thank you. Answer questions. Yes, Michael.
And what, why was renovation itself so the economic tool of choice? In other words, why did they just knock everything down? Was it because had you constructed the walls were much more difficult to, much more expensive to meet, or was it because just the economics?
Well, I think it's several things. I think, of course, it would have been more expensive, plus you would have had to assemble a lot. And so on the 20-foot wide lots, the 18 to 25-foot wide lots, it would have been very difficult to build a taller, more economically viable building. Now, Pepe also assembled sites and sponsored apartment houses. So he also, at the same time he was rehabilitating buildings, he was demolishing buildings as well. In fact, on the south side of Waverly Place, right across from 124, he and Vitolo built one of those apartment houses. But I think the most important thing is that it was a rundown neighborhood. It was still a large immigrant neighborhood. It had a lot of rooming houses and a small bohemian group. And it was very inexpensive to do this. Pepe did not invest a lot of money in doing this. And you could easily make a return on your investment, as he did over and over again. And he then inspired others to do the same. So I think that you inexpensively could do this, and after it first took off, Pepe, I think, really understood that he was creating a new neighborhood, and his family had been in real estate in the village for a while. They were on Washington Square South, and he saw that the market for the village was increasing, and that thus his income was going to increase. So it was a real estate, a savvy real estate issue. Yeah.
When did the use of exterior fire escapes, when was that mandated? Why was it mandated? How come we still see them?
Well, it was mandated in the 1860s on tenements. There was a law in the early 1862 that mandated fire escapes. There was no on tenements, but there was no way to enforce it at the time. And still, they're mandated on buildings that are not a fireproof construction. And the law allowed me to build semi-fireproof construction of up to 6 stories. So that's why 6-story apartment houses have fire escapes and taller ones mostly do not. And then a number of these buildings, like this one, they got fire escapes later. In order to legalize residents, some of these buildings had to add fire escapes. to them because they didn't have sprinkler systems inside. If you have a sprinkler system inside, you can actually remove the fire escape. Yes?
Can you tell me the reason for removing the stoops?
Yes. Well, first of all, the stoops kind of goes out of fashion. That's one issue. By the late 19th century, new row houses were being built without stoops. So that's one issue. The other issue is that if you're converting it into apartments, in a row house with a stoop, if you own it, you go up the front stairs and into the hall. But if you're a servant or a delivery, you go under the stoop and in. So that's two entrances. So you didn't need two entrances. So by removing the stoop and putting the entrance in the basement, what had formerly been the front hall could now become a part of the apartment in the front. And that's what happens in many of these buildings. So you actually gained rentable space by removing the stoop. Plus, it was unfashionable. Yeah?
The Washington Square North houses have survived and are lovely. What were the houses like in the South, and why were they destroyed?
They were very similar. And actually, there's a photograph in my book of one of the rows on Washington Square South became a major artist center. In fact, one of the buildings was called the House of Genius. And the brick row houses were filled with artists' studio windows, and it became a major artist center. It's the building's where the law school is now. They were just bought by NYU and by developers and torn down. The same thing was true on Washington Square West. Also had beautiful row houses.
When were they destroyed?
Mostly in the 30s and the 40s. But the law school was, what, late 30s, early 40s? I can't remember. Yes?
Did many of the reconstructed houses install elevators? Like what, 24 Waverly Place?
In the village, never, because they were divided into apartments or almost never. I should never say never. They were divided into apartments, and they were usually four stories, so that was considered, legally, that was okay for a walk-up. In some of the single-family houses on the east side that were done for very affluent people, they put in elevators. But even that's pretty rare.
Well, I live on Waverly Place, and I was told there's been lots of reconstruction going on. And I was told of two houses that installed elevators.
Well, that could be more recent. I mean, more recently, as you know, the houses have become single-family homes again, owned by very affluent people. People have put in elevators, but. I'm sure there may be some examples, but I've never found any examples from this period when elevators were added. Yes?
On that floor plan that I think people would make in that building, you showed the closets where they could have been a kitchen. When were bathrooms installed? And if they didn't have bathrooms,
did
they have outhouses in the back? Or?
Many of these houses were built originally with plumbing. Plumbing starts up here in the 18th. Once the Croton Aqueduct opens in the 1840s, you begin to get plumbing inside houses. Most of them had been retrofitted with plumbing, even if they were earlier. So they had at least primitive plumbing in most buildings. There outhouses by the teens. Outhouses in the village were probably pretty rare. But all of these, they always have bathrooms added. You're not going to get these middle-class young single people to rent in buildings that didn't have bathrooms in them. So they all have bathrooms in them. Yes?
I was told that 55 Morgan Street used to be either three tenements or three townhouses, that the owner's brother was an architect combined to make that building, which has an elevator.
I don't know. I don't know 55 Morton off the top of my head, so I can't really comment on that. So I don't know. I'm going to have to look at it.
Because it fits the style.
Yeah. Yes.
You have us concerned for any alteration to these very special buildings, and I think you've more than convinced us that they're very special in respect. In all of your research, were you ever concerned about any of those rehabilitated buildings replacing anything that might have been more architecturally significant?
Well, of course, that's the conundrum of historic preservation. Aren't we sorry that we lost the Waldorf Astoria for the Empire State Building? You have to deal with what you've got. I don't argue that every alteration ever made to any building should be preserved. You know, in many cases, somebody came along in the village and they locked the stoop off and that's it. But if there was a design concept, I think that we need to stop and ask the question, are we going to lose something if we don't preserve this? And so I think it's important. And I think, you know, sometimes it brings up issues that we have trouble with. This house here, this is on the corner of Grove and Bedford. And at one point, the owner of this house that was redone in 1920 came in and wanted to restore the Greek Revival design, which you can see next door here. This is what it looked like. And I have to say, to their credit, Landmark said no, which is not always the case. They have permitted, even in very recently, the destruction of some of these buildings, to my irritation. And so the owner was very good, and the owner said fine, and did a magnificent restoration of the 1920 design. And then they were going to sell the house, and the realtor must have told them they could get more money if it had a stoop on it. And so they came to Landmarks to restore the stoop. And I went to Landmarks and I testified. And it was really hard to explain to them why it was important to have a house without the stoop on it. That, you know, that's what this design was all about. That's a key issue, is removing the stoops. And ultimately, the owner decided against it. Landmarks never voted on that. The owner withdrew the application for it. So it's still there. Restore. Yes.
In the second decade, Edmund's house was restored.
Yes.
They have it. Well, Trump has so much. Same time period with all of this going on.
Absolutely.
Any comment about how that cuts through and what resulted in those property?
Well, I mean, it lost a lot of great buildings. It did have the advantage from the point of view of the real estate market of making the village even more convenient. By putting in the subway and putting in 7th Avenue, and then a few years later doing the same thing on 6th Avenue. So, I mean, it created a scar right through the village, and it created all those wacky little triangular sites. Am I glad it happened? No. But it's there, and we have to deal with it.
My question is, in terms of the new architecture that had to be created to fill out those bizarre...
Well, they're mostly taxpayers. One and two-story buildings. There are a couple of old tenements that actually got new facades on them. But mostly it was people were building innocuous one and two-story buildings, many of which still survive there. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a really old wooden house. I don't remember the date. It's early 19th century, I think. I can't remember the date. And, of course, they all became kind of very picturesque little houses.
Yeah. That was a carpenter, that little house. That was a cabinet maker, I believe, in New York City. And that little house was his woodworking shop, which is now a guest house. Mm-hmm.
For the house on the corner.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, there's a lot of misinformation about the Minettas. Pepe was involved with creating the Minettas. He proposed that the Minettas become the new Latin Quarter of New York. There's a great photograph in the book where Pepe says to be the new Latin Quarter of New York. Or I think he calls it the Quartier Latin, actually. But he actually lost it. I don't know exactly what happened, but financially he lost the property. And it was somebody else actually did the Minettas, and he was very embittered, and he was very critical of what they did. He said their rents were so high they make me look like a piker. Then shortly after it was rehabilitated, of course 6th Avenue cuts through and a lot of the houses are destroyed. But it's part of this. There's a whole another story here that I didn't talk about tonight, which is the enclaves, the Minettas, McDougal Sullivan Gardens, Grove Court, Patchen Place, Milligan Place, St. John's Garden, and others that create another kind of lifestyle in the village that's very closely related to this, which I discuss in the book. Yeah.
Okay. I have two questions.
when you did the research, did you come across, you know, similar conversions from ground floor like apartments to commercial spaces? Was there any trends in that?
Adding commercial spaces into these buildings.
Greenwich,
sometimes that happened on Greenwich, on Hudson. You see that too. There's no pattern to it, but it does happen, but not that often. I think that at the time, people felt they could make more money from the residential rents than from the commercial rents.
The other question is quickly, in terms of the conversions, the investment in the property, did the people who were owners retain them for a long term or were they short term?
Heavy was a short term owner mostly. He sold them as fast as he could if he could make a profit on it. That's not always the case, but it was the case in a lot of these. Yeah, you had a question.
I'm interested in this question you laid about judging and balancing the value of the original appearance and the altered appearance. You know, in the non-landmark district, 211 West 22nd Street, a couple of years ago, was renovated to its original 1855. It's quite accurate. It's a handsome building. And I just wish you'd talk about that a little more. Do the altered versions have more value because they physically exist and you're replacing them with something artificial going back?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think I'd rather have something real than something that's an imitation. But I also think there's a place for restoration. There are certainly rows in the village where the brownstone has just been shaved off, and I have, you know, it was probably deteriorated. It was easier to take it off than to restore it. And I'm fully in favor of restoring that facade. So I'm not advocating that just because it changed, you need to keep it. I'm only saying that this is part of an important movement that we may not have recognized, but certainly they did at the time, and it got huge amounts of publicity, and that we should look at this in a positive way. They were trying to create a new image of urban living, and that some of these are very valuable, and we should value them today just as much as we value the Greek Revival row houses or the brownstone houses. So my point is not just because it was changed, we need to preserve it, but if the change was to create something with an artistic intent, or a social intent, then I think that we need to give it a second thought. So that's what I'm all in favor of restoring buildings that are in deteriorated condition. And that has happened in the historic district wonderfully in many cases. Yes, anyone else?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I've always been curious about the houses that are behind the houses, like at Perry Street. There are a number of them on Second Avenue. Where did they carve the space? Because
in the backyard, all these houses had rear yards, and in some cases, those rear tenements, like on Perry Street, those were built when this was an immigrant neighborhood, and they just stuck another rear tenement in the back,
taking part of
the garden, what had been the yard of the house. In other cases, like at 124 Waverly, and a number of the houses on Waverly and Washington Place, they built little artist studios in the back that would then additional rental income, and then they would create a small landscape garden in between the house and the little studio in the back. Yes?
How would you characterize the Landmarks Commission's attitude today towards the question you raised about the value of...
It's an uphill battle. Last year, there's a very important late example of this movement in Carnegie Hill that was done in the late 30s. A woman who had been a congresswoman from Arizona, the first woman ever elected to Congress who was not related to somebody who had previously held the seat. And after her retirement, she moved to New York. She bought two deteriorated houses, and she hired a very, very, very prestigious architect named William Bottomley, who had also done Turtle Bay Gardens, to redesign the facade, and it was a stucco Regency-inspired facade. And Landmarks gave permission to create this kind of phony early 19th century design based on an earlier rejected design by Bottomley. They gave a permit for this. It still boggles my mind that they did this. You had real work by Bottomley, and now we've got this phony pastiche there. But I'm trying. And I've convinced a number of the preservation organizations that once spoke enthusiastically about removing these. I've convinced them that this is the right path. So I'm optimistic. One more question. Especially the artist studios. I think, once everybody doesn't notice them, and I've been amazed at how, as I've been working on this project, and I pointed this out to friends who live in Greenwich Village, and suddenly the next time I see them, they say, wow, I never realized there were so many artist studios or so many steel casement windows. And I think that there is an appreciation of that here. A few years ago, I can't remember how many years ago it was, Landmark State Commission for somebody between 5th and 6th Avenues to take the studio window off. I'm not sure they would do that today, though, but it did happen. So I'm optimistic. So thank you all.